So in recent Sunday evenings, we've been thinking about these close encounters with God, people who encountered God in a particular way. We thought about Isaiah's close encounter with God in the throne room. We thought of Moses' close encounter with God in the desert. And this evening, we're going to be looking at Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego's close encounter with God in the fiery furnace. It's a really familiar story. Let me just recap some of the details. God's people, in the main, had abandoned the one true and living God. So they'd turned to and they'd adopted the customs, the practices and the idols of the nations around them, the surrounding nations. So they were spiritually adulterous. They were morally corrupt. That was God's people of the time. So what God did over a period of time was to send prophets, spokesmen, prophets who would speak God's word to them, and God's intention was to woo them away from idolatry and warn them of the dangers they were in if they didn't let go of those idols. But as we see the unfolding history of God's people, we see that they refused to listen, and they refused to loosen their grip on the idols that had become so dear to them. So, Yahweh, Jehovah God, sent the Assyrians, and then he sent the Babylonians to defeat them, to humiliate them, to exile them. And that's what we see happening in the history of God's people. There were a number of exiles, a phased exile really from Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar. And among the masses who went from Jerusalem and the surrounding places to Babylon were a faithful few of God's people. And among them were Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. So just a remnant of faithful, godly people there in the exile. And these four men, young men, maybe just teenagers, were taken into the service of Nebuchadnezzar, who was the most powerful man in the world, the ruler of the most powerful supernation in the world. And one of the things he did was to change their names from Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah to Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. And they had to come to terms with a new culture. They had to come to terms with new customs. They were given new names. And they were very much learning to live in a hostile world, in a hostile environment far from home. I guess every day brought new pressures on them as God's people, pressures to conform, pressures from those in authority, those exerting power above them, and pressure to conform from the majority, the people who were with them, the people who lived life with them. Two kinds of pressures, a pressure from authority, a pressure from the majority. And that pressure must have told. They must have felt that in many ways. But as we come to the book of Daniel, we see particularly Daniel being faithful. The story so far is that these young men remained faithful to God. They'd stood firm, they'd remained faithful, they'd been prayerful, and God blessed them. God blessed them with brilliance. They were honored in a number of ways. They were given positions of responsibility. They were outstanding amongst their peers. We see them being faithful in the small things. They were worthy of trust in the smaller things. And they were given trust in greater things. But as we approach chapter 3, what we see here is literally the heat being turned up on that pressure to conform, the pressure on God's people to conform. The question really is, as we turn to chapter 3, is will they still stand? Will these remnant of God's people still stand, or will they fall flat. So that's really going to capture our imagination, our thoughts as we work through this sort of standing. Will they stand? So we're going to look at three things tonight. We're going to see them standing up. We're going to see them standing out. And we're going to see them standing in. So standing up to authority. We're going to see them standing out in the crowd. And then we'll see them standing in the midst of the flames. And we'll use those titles just to help us through this long, long passage. So here's the first thing then. Let's see them standing up to authority. Let me set the scene for you. We're just going to note a number of things from the reading, that the statue, the location, the occasion, and the command. Here's the first thing. Let's note this huge statue that Nebuchadnezzar set up. 90 feet high, 9 foot wide. It's made of gold, probably plated gold rather than solid. It's imposing, it's dominating, it's the focal point for these thousands of people who had been forcibly gathered to that place on that occasion. Let me just give some perspective to that statue. The Angel of the North is a colossal 20 meters high. It's huge. It's the height of four double-decker buses. But the Angel of the North is still a good 7 meters shorter than Nebuchadnezzar's statue. I think it's safe to assume that the statue was almost certainly of himself. Think of the previous chapter, chapter 2, this dream that he has of this statue, and Daniel tells him, "You are the head." I think that went to his head, actually, and he's built this huge statue in his own honour. So that's the statue. The writer here wants us to note the location. It's the plain of Jura. So that would have been close to the city of Babylon. It was a flat plain surrounded by hills. So it would have created a kind of a natural amphitheatre for the people to gather there on that the occasion. And we can also see it was a multinational gathering. So the strategy of the conquering Babylonians, when they'd conquered a nation, was to bring them back to Babylon. So Babylon was a very multicultural place. And we can see that reflected in this story. People from all nations gathered there and all brought with the same purpose to bow to this image of Nebuchadnezzar. It's a huge statue in this natural amphitheater, and the occasion was the dedication service, the dedication of this statue. And what an occasion it was. I think the reading really helps us grasp something of the pomp and the ceremony of the occasion. If you were irritated by the repetition of the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the advisors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, and all of that, if you were irritated by that, I think you were meant to be. The writer was taking you there. That's what it was like. Oh, it was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous occasion. It was kind of like a crazy coronation or something like that. A royal wedding, a kind of something which was just quite pompous in so many ways. You know, the Prime Minister was there, the Cabinet was there, the Mayor was there, the Royal Family was there, the Archbishop of Canterbury, all the big wigs and the high flyers and gowns and hats and horses and carriages and marching and bands and parades and bells. It was one of those occasions. It was a palaver. I think that's what the writer was helping us to see. And then there was a command. There was a command. If there was some humour conveyed by the writer, the command was no laughing matter. This occasion was no garden party. The crowd that day were not merely spectators. And they're all gathered there to hear this loud command. See that in verses 4 to 6, a herald gave this command. Maybe he blew a trumpet to get their attention. He heralds something. And the herald is a command. Verse 6, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded." Not offering any advice here. This is optional. You take it or leave it. "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." Here's the stark reality for those three Jews: bow or burn. Bow or burn. The pressure from those in authority is really hotting up. I guess we could say something similar in the UK, for sure, not to this kind of extent. But we've noticed something, haven't we, of the heat being turned up from those in authority, our lawmakers, our law enforcers. Being a practicing Christian in this country can set you on a collision course with those in authority. I don't know if you subscribe to the Christian Institute or Christian Concern for Our Nation. They often feed news stories through of street preachers, of hoteliers, of employees who have run into some kind of trouble in one way or another, facing fine or even imprisonment. The heat has been notched up in recent years. I've said this to you before. I think in my lifetime I've noticed from society those attitudes have changed from sympathy to apathy to hostility. That journey's happened in my lifetime. So learning to stand up in the right way to those in authority is actually something UK Christians are increasingly going to have to learn to do. We'll pick up a little later in the story of how best to do that. How can we, how should we best stand up in this hostile environment? What is it we need to be faithful to God and put authority in that right place in our thinking and in the working out, the mechanics of living a Christian life in 21st century Britain? So, we've noticed them standing up. Let's note them standing out. So they were standing up to authority. Let's note them then standing out in the crowd. Would you picture yourself actually in that crowd? That might be really helpful for you to do. Imagine you'd been called, summoned to the plain of Jura. You can see the statue, it's hard to miss, it's huge. You've heard the command. It's the moment of truth. You are commanded to bow. This is for real. The choice is simple, it's bow or burn. The music begins. It's bow or burn. Your heart begins pounding, it's bow or burn. Your mouth is dry, it's bow or burn. And as the sound of the band travels across the valley, the people from front to back begin to bow. It's kind of a Mexican wave. Well, they're not waving, they're bowing. A little Babylonian bow. They're all bowing. And then it gets closer to you. It's your turn to bow. It's your turn to bow. The people in front of you, the people beside you, the people behind you have now bowed. What about you? Maybe some of those who have bowed next to you notice a space on the ground where you should be. And they turn and say to you, bow. Bow. It's not worth it. It's not worth standing. Even if you don't mean it, just bow. And you're left standing alone in the crowd. Everyone's bowing bar you. Actually, that's a very familiar phrase, isn't it? Everybody's doing it. I wonder how many times have you heard that as a parent from your kids? Everybody's doing it. Or teenagers in school. Everybody's doing it. You can do it too. It's the pressure of the majority. We've considered something of the pressure of the authority, of those in authority. But increasingly there's pressure from the majority. It's hard to stand out in the crowd, isn't it? It's hard to be the one. I spoke at a youth meeting on Friday night and had an open question time. And one of the questions was, my friends make fun of me because I'm a Christian. It's hard. What do I say? How do I do that? How do I deal with that? I don't know if you've ever been to a football match and there's a whistle blows and the crowd exits and you're going with them. But then you realise you've left your program on the seat and you try to go back for your program and the crowd is... It's so hard, isn't it, to push against the crowd. That's what it's like. Standing, pushing against the majority. It's contra flow. The narrow road that leads to life is contra flow. So how do we do it? How are Christians to stand up to authority? How are Christians to stand out in the crowd? One word. It's faith. Faith. Faith believes God is with me. Faith believes God is for me. Faith believes that God has the power to deal with the consequences, whatever they may be. Faith doesn't go with the flow. Faith is the one thing that will enable you to stand up in the crowd or stand up against authority and to stand out in the crowd. Faith doesn't listen to the voice of the crowd. Faith doesn't listen to the voices of those in authority in these kind of circumstances. Faith always listens primarily to God. What is faith? It's listening to what God says and living in the light of it. Hearing what God says and putting it into practice. That's faith. Faith made real by action. Listen to what Spurgeon said. Our job is to do what is right, though the heavens fall, consequences belong to God. Our job is to do what is right, though the heavens fall, consequences lie with God. I don't know if you've ever wondered how this story would have gone if those three young men had bowed that day. How the story would have rolled if they'd have bowed with the crowd, buckled under the pressure, bent the knee for fear of burning. Stories turn on moments like this. Stories turn on these moments where our faith is put under the spotlight. I'll tell you the story of a young man who wrote to me after a summer camp. He'd come to faith. On that camp, he was writing to express his thankfulness for the ministry and for the team. And I went to his baptism and he went to university full of hope and expectation. I ended up sharing a house with some guys who were doing drugs. Here's the moment on which his story would turn. What would he do? Would he stand against the crowd? Sadly, he's a young man who ended up in a mess. Ended up in rehab. My prayer still is that God has not finished with him yet. But I do know from Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego's story, I know from this young lad's story, that stories turn on moments like this. Faith is the pen that can write a different story. Faith says with the psalmist, the Lord is with me. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? Do you know the story of Richard Wurmbrand? Imprisoned and tortured for his faith in communist Romania. The story really is moving, it's inspirational. Listen to his faith in the face of his captors. His captors not only tortured him, but also his family. He said, they can take everything I have, but they can't take the touch of his nail-pierced hand for my life. What enables a man to say that? It's only faith. Only faith enables a man to speak in such a way. It's ever so unlikely that we will ever face a fiery furnace or the kind of awful persecution that Richard Wurmbrand experienced. But nevertheless, what enabled Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego to stand up to authority, stand out in the crowd, what enabled Richard Wurmbrand to persevere through all those trials was faith. Believing what God has said and allowing those things to work themselves out in their lives. Faith says, I'd rather die and face God sooner than die later and face him with regrets. So you all know the very familiar story of Latimer and Ridley. So it's the 16th century. They're imprisoned for a while in the Tower of London for the crime of preaching without a license, of all things. And then in the spring of 1555, they were both tied to a piece of wood and burnt. They got the kindling and set them ablaze. They were just so full of faith in that moment. Play the man, Master Ridley. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out. Look at verse 17, Daniel 3. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up, whether our tomorrows be filled with good or ill. However this turns out, whatever the outcome, I want you to know, I won't bow. I'm not going to bow. Why? Because I believe in God. I believe he's real. He's the one true living God. Because I believe he'll be with me. He's promised to be with me and never leave me nor forsake me. And it was really with that kind of attitude that these three lads faced up to the most powerful man on the planet. Did you notice how Nebuchadnezzar gave them another chance to bow? He said, okay, I'll let you off. You didn't bow, but I'll let you off that if you bow now. The pressure will be persistent. It is seen to be persistent here. It is persistence in our lives. This is something we will increasingly face again and again. These confrontations to our faith. But the lads refused to bow again and were filled with this God-given confidence and faith for that moment. They gave no defense, no apology, no excuses. Did you love the way they said to King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't have to answer you on this. We don't have to say anything. They knew who really sat on the throne. They knew who the real superpower was. So no defense, no excuses, no apology. Their faith enabled them to look into the face of the most powerful man on the planet and say with the apostles, we must obey God rather than men. And Nebuchadnezzar at this moment, he believes he's holding all the aces. And he threatens them. He threatens them with the fire. He mocks their God. And they reply, whatever. Whatever. Do your worst. Our God is able to save us. And we believe he will ultimately save us from your hand. But even if he doesn't save us from the furnace, we have faith enough to believe he will deliver us in the end. That this will turn out in the end. You know, whatever your threats might be, we must be obedient and leave the consequences up to God. That's what they're saying. We'll be faithful and leave the consequences up to God. We don't fully know what will happen to us, but we do know this. We will not serve your gods or worship the image that you have set up. I think the fire in their bellies was hotter than the fire in the furnace, don't you think? Oh, for that fire. Oh, for that fire. Will you join me in praying for that fire? For us? What do our kids need? In school? What do our teenagers need as they go to university? What do employers and employees need? Need this fire. Need this fire from God that just couldn't be extinguished. A fire that believes, if God be for us, who can be against us? I don't know if you're a fearful person. Our temperaments are different, aren't they? Wondering how you might stand in this hostile world. I have no simple 3-point plan for you. I have nothing that will cushion it to the extent that you're not going to feel pain in the future if you're a Christian. When Jesus said, if you come after me, take up your cross. It's going to hurt. There's going to be pain in this journey. But can I encourage you to, in faith, think like the sheep in Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, even though I walk through the deepest, darkest valley, I will not be afraid. Why will you not be afraid in those moments? Because you are with me. You promised to be with me. Faith believes that. Faith believes it. And if you are with me, I can stand. If you are with me, I can speak. Whatever is needed, faith will fit me for the hour. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is enraged, as you can imagine. Verses 19 and 20. Crank it up, he's saying. Turn it on full. Turn it to max. So the furnace was set up as a kind of deterrent, but it was no idle threat. I think we see Nebuchadnezzar's anger burning as hot as the furnace. So standing up, standing out, see them standing in the midst of the flames. So the furnace is likely to be in this kind of like huge pot with an opening on the top and a door at the front. So opening at the top, you'd thrown into a door at the front through which it could be stoked. These three young men were bound. They were carried up steps or a ramp close enough to be thrown into the furnace. The fire was so hot that even some of the soldiers who were escorting them died in the process. So their death was a certainty. Or was it? Verses 24 and 25. Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He rose up in hate. You can just imagine him watching this happening. Seeing those soldiers die. The bodies fall into the furnace. And then He just shoots up off his chair. What? What's going on? Am I seeing things here? He's astonished. He rose up in haste. And he declared to his council, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? And they answered, King, true. But I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar here is using terminology that he's familiar with to describe the fourth person that he sees in the flames. He's describing this kind of supernatural angelic being in a way that he was perhaps used to. A son of the gods, he said. We would call this a theophany. A theophany, an earthly close encounter with God. They stood for God, and God came and stood with them in the flames, protecting them from harm, miraculously ensuring that the natural effects of the heat, the flames and the smoke just didn't harm them or touch them in any way. And here's the big point, really. These three men were not saved from the flames. On this occasion, these men were saved in the flames. God didn't spare them from the flames, but he spared them in the flames. There's a real lesson there for God's people. God, in his perfect purposes, sometimes allows his people to pass through the hottest of trials. But not to harm them, only to hone them. Not to slay them, but only to shape them. Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things, even fiery furnaces, that God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For we know those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed or shaped to the likeness of his son. God is doing something. He's refining us in the fires. As we said earlier, UK Christians have been feeling a little bit of the heat of late. But think back to your GCSE science lessons. Heat changes things. Heat changes things. God does lead into these trials, but he never leaves us in these trials. Be assured of a close encounter with the living God. He's there even when you can't see him, even when you can't feel him. What was perhaps the scariest moments on earth for these three men became their close encounter with God. Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. And I am with you always, even to the end of the age. The most precious metal is forged in the hottest of furnaces. So illness and loss and loneliness and conflict and abandonment and disappointment and persecution, in them all, please be assured that God is with you, that God is for you, and God is working on you. Will you remember that? God is with you, God is for you, God is working on you. Faith believes that. Faith lives in the light of that. So they were not saved from the flames, but they were saved in the flames. Standing up, standing out, standing in. And then the passage ends with their standing elevated. Verses 28 to 30. But for their stand, this story would have petered out with a fire in an unused furnace. But as it was, as a result of their faith, they encountered God in a new way. A new law is passed. God is praised. And his people are promoted. Who knows what impact your faith could have on this hostile world? Stories turn on moments like these. Your story will turn on a moment like this. Who knows if your story could be used by God to turn this nation's story. As God's people were called to live by faith, and if necessary, to die by faith. But whatever, in living or dying, faith enables you to realize you can't lose. You can't lose. It was something Paul realized as he wrote to the Philippians from prison. For to me, to live and to die is gain. I've got the best of both worlds. If I get to live, I get to live for Christ. If I die, I get to be with him. Nobody can beat me. God, would you grant us such a conviction as that?